You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Welcome to another Damn Fine Cup of Culture. This month's episode is another in our occasional series of second chances where one of us selects a film for a rewatch. A rewatch that will hopefully give them a chance to reappraise their original opinion. Was their first reaction correct, or has time healed all wounds? Joining me today to give another film a second chance is Sam. Hello, Sam.
Hello there, Alan.
So we just dive straight into things, and I think we're going to go direct into your choice for a second chance. What film did you select and why?
Oh, God, that's going to be a difficult session today. I feel like I'm, you know, meeting my psychologist to talk about my childhood trauma film. The film that literally kept me from sleeping when I was about 11 years old. And I think there's a bit of a backstory that I also wrote in an article about parental guidance suggested about at one point. It's basically that my parents let me watch a lot of movies when I was a child, and I think they were not very age appropriate. There are very many examples. This is clearly the worst one. It's Luchino Visconti's The Damned, or La Caduta degli Dei from 1969. So basically, they let me watch the film. I didn't sleep a wink, and I kept thinking about this film probably for a long time. And it stuck with me in like images and scenes that I couldn't really put together anymore in a logical sense of what the entire film was all about. I remembered, obviously, it was about a family. It was about industrialists during Nazi times. And there were some very gruesome moments that I remembered very graphically. And that's it. And I've never seen it in full since. Only like read articles about it or learned a little bit about the production history and saw other Visconti films. I never really dared go back to this one for obvious reasons.
I was going to ask you that. So this is the first time returning to the scene of the trauma.
Yes, yes. I remember it was once on YouTube and in its entirety, and I started it for about 10 minutes. And then really, I was hesitant if I really wanted to rewatch it again. Obviously, knowing that this is a well-regarded film. I like Visconti a lot. It's a filmmaker that I got to know very early in life, which is also very weird. It's not your usual first director encounter, but maybe Visconti was kind of the first director that I was aware of, even as a teenager, and that I watched films by and then got into other directors because of that.
Yeah, it was certainly a film that I hadn't seen before. So this was a new one on me to watch afresh. But I guess like for you, there was this like childhood viewing. So what was it like to go back? How did you prepare yourself to watch it again this time in full?
Well, I got the best possible version, the Criterion Collection, you know, restored version in collaboration with Cinemateca in Bologna. They came up with this beautifully restored version. And I think the thing that sticks out, obviously, is the quality of the image, especially the use of colors. This is mostly made in Cinecittà studios with one big notable exception, or a couple big notable exceptions, I guess. So Visconti was very masterful at using color. So I wanted to see it in its best possible version. I was aware of the Maurice Jarre music because I had it somewhere on record and on like compilation CD. So I also wanted to make sure that I heard it properly. And of course, the big challenge with The Damned is that which language are you going to watch it in? Because based on lip syncing, it was made in English, but then of course, redubbed into all kinds of versions, especially Italian and German at the time. And so I did watch it in its English version, even though it's a dubbed English version. So that's how I prepared myself for the experience.
And without, you know, making this too much of a therapy, what was in the film that you were most worried about rewatching? What was the bit that you remember traumatizing you?
Well, there were two things. I mean, it's for those people who know about The Damned, it's very famous, not just for the Nazi era context, but also because there's a clear example of incest shown on screen, like a mother and son relationship where he, you know, gets a very controlling role towards his family in general. And then his mother, how he subjugates her by the end of the film. And that was, of course, you know, I think I just didn't understand what was going on, but I saw that this was clearly sickening. That was the one thing. And the other thing I think is that probably like the centerpiece of the film, it's the historic situation of the SS brutally slaughtering most of the elite SA troops at Bad Wiese, so kind of this power struggle among the Nazi stormtroopers, who would be, you know, come out on top, and then Himmler and the SS kind of staging this night of the long knives, as it was called. And this is, I think, probably the masterpiece in this film is like an almost mute scene, a long build-up of all these SA soldiers celebrating and getting more and more drunk and getting more and more raunchy. And of course, also the gay context that is also historically interesting here that comes out more and more. And then towards the early morning hours, the SS troops show up and they just, you know, raise them to the ground. There's all these guns shooting at mostly naked men. And I can see why this was so traumatizing for me to see as a teenager, not, you know, having any idea about the historical situation. And then just these basic images of like industrial steel against human gay bodies. And I think that was so, I think under the surface, without really understanding what it was, that's probably what caused much of my, you know, trauma at the time.
I can understand that, because that whole sequence, it isn't conventional. It is its own thing. It takes its own time to go through that sequence. And you could imagine it in a more conventional film, that it would be presented in a more dramatic way that would be easier to take in. That, okay, this is a betrayal. This is a political thing that happened. And you could see it being realized that, like, you have, let's put it this way, one set of Nazi bad guys having a party and another set turn up and kill them. That would be dramatic. You could watch it. But this almost isn't that. It's like, I am going to show you a long extended scene of first the party and then the massacre. And it's almost presented as its own thing. Like, I'm going to show you this rather than put it within the dramatic context of a story that you think, oh, who, or what, this character's been got rid of and this character's doing well. It is just, here is something that happened that was horrible. And I think that must make it especially devoid of a level of context that you'd expect even quite young. That must have been quite shocking. I found that quite sort of hard to digest, because, yeah, it's just suddenly presenting you with something for the sake of saying almost this is this horrible thing that happened.
And the scene itself is so cleverly built up, I think, starting with an almost like documentary style, just observing all these festivities, all this drinking and all this celebrating and dancing. And then I think more and more it's being aestheticized. I think also with the use of color and light, by the time there are all these like still frames of these inebriated men just sitting around and kind of, you know, approaching each other and disappearing with each other. So it has this dreamlike quality more and more. And then, of course, it switches to just these boats arriving with the SS men and the terrible violence that breaks out. So it's also, I think, very disturbing in terms of also the silence and the lack of like dialogue and the lack of characters from the actual film. I think there's just one within the SA men that is part of the von Essenbeck family in other scenes. And then, of course, Dirk Bogarde comes in and couple of the guys who you knew from the film already. But yeah, it is devoid of that context. And I think that makes it such a standout scene. I think that's also the scene that Visconti wanted to put at the center, and he filmed it first. And I think it's very much his centerpiece to the film, and it makes total sense. But then there's all the rest. And I think that makes it such an interesting film altogether.
I mean, when you said you sort of cited the sort of documentary aspect of it, I think that is definitely true. And this was the first time I watched it. I'd not watched this before. So this was what my original watch is as part of Second Chances. And what really struck me at that point is how, it, I think, deliberately jarring it is that it switches to this very different style that doesn't involve the characters. And then I have to admit, for a long time when it started, I was a bit, what is going on here? This party is going on. And that was sort of, it took a while for me to sort of reframe what I'm watching to get round, oh no, this is the centerpiece of the film. This is sort of why it is here, is not because it just ticks another story beat in act whatever of the script. It is something very different that is meant to sort of shock. And I think that across the board with this film in many different ways, what really struck me on this first watch is the way that aspects of evil in it are presented in a way that you can't easily accept through dramatization. Like, you're like, okay, these are bad men, they'll do bad things. You've seen it in dozens of films. The way it's presented is that it feels quite genuinely repulsive or slightly disturbing. And I think when I was watching it, the bit that I really was felt jarring is, I think there's such a heavy hint of child abuse. And how that's presented is not in terms of, okay, this film is about this issue. It is just there. You can't deny it. It's not cryptic. But its presentation, it's very hard to not have quite an emotional reaction to it that you can't then mollify by thinking, yeah, but this is a story about how this person might get punished, or this is a story about how the victim then dealt with it. It is just presented as this sort of repulsive thing that is happening in this bigger family saga. And that, I think, was like a really powerful aspect of the film, because I've not seen it much. I've not seen films do that.
Mm-hmm. And I'd forgotten about that aspect. You know, once Helmut Berger, the central character, the son, Martin of the family, comes up at first, you know, when he has this Marlene Dietrich performance at the beginning, you think, well, he's going to be the homosexual character in this very patriarchal society, so he's going to be victimized. And then more and more, you realize that he's actually already immoral and the villain of the piece, basically. And then he makes his way up, grabs more and more power, and also has these like child abuse moments throughout the film, right? I completely forgotten about that part because, you know, the trauma was coming from so many other directions. But then by the end, when he has turned into this complete Nazi who has subjugated not just his mother, but I think erased most of his other competition in the family, there's this horrifying like wedding scene at the end, including that poisoning of the mother and her new husband. I mean, there's just things out of a horror film. I had a lot of like flashbacks to Dario Argento. I think also because the use of color maybe and the giallo aesthetics were also there. I thought this family house with these ghostly faces and these villains, the aesthetics. Sometimes I thought, well, I'm in the middle of a horror piece, and I think that that's very fitting. And it's, on the other hand, when I saw the Bad Wiese scene, I thought of Cabaret for other reasons. Also, the, you know, this kind of slow Nazi takeover atmosphere that the Cabaret film uses for very different effects, but kind of the aesthetics and obviously the same era that these films were made in also had these hints of like other genres, but basically you're watching something quite unique.
And I think what I was really struck by is I think the sort of film starts and you think you've got a bit of a handle on it because it is the story of this like von Essenbeck family. They're a wealthy industrial family within Germany, and the Nazis are coming to power. And you have this dynamic where, okay, we're not all Nazis, but, you know, it might be good for business. We can work with these people. And you sort of start following it. And I kind of, having recently really enjoyed the TV series Succession, I was kind of like, okay, I get family saga. I'm into this. And I kind of probably expected the more standard storylines or tropes of a wealthy family saga at war. And the fact that then it doesn't so much focus on that as the sort of darkness, as the sort of say, you know, almost, oh, they say they're not Nazis but they'll deal with the Nazis. So maybe they're slightly good. They're a slightly better family. But within that family, there is already like absolutely horrible things that are just slightly suppressed below the surface. This sort of wealthy industrialist family, the darkness they already have is what is going to be magnified by Nazism and destroy them. So again, that it's not a conventional story. And I kept hoping for, so can I just have someone nice, or can I just have someone who, like, even if it's someone evil that I can then go, right, I'm just going to boo hiss you doing evil things. But it never lets you have something, an easy angle to do that. It's just like you're seeing the story, but you are going to see something dark that you're not going to like, because these people are damned and there's a reason they are. And I found that like incredibly powerful. And I can definitely imagine if you watched it young, that this is more than seeing maybe even a giallo film, or maybe even a film that had, you know, Nazis being villainous in it with a bit of a bleak ending. I think that you could watch as a kid because there's a level of context that really helps you get through it that this just doesn't have. It shows you horrible things without, I think, giving you an easy out to process them. They are just there because this is a horrible world we're now in.
Yeah, this cuts very much deeper, I think. And I think you can really feel the decay and the decadence the downfall, the moral downfall of this family. But you're right, of course, the decadence is already there. This family is already rotten from the core. And I think even this beginning where you have still the patriarch in place that's shortly after is killed at the beginning of the film, I think there is still this sense of succession, right? Where they talk about who will take over and you think, well, this is what the plot is going to be all about. Which of these sons and which of these children will somehow make up their way that up the ladder to power. And that plays a role for a while. I think it's really interesting also this von Essenbeck, this industrial aspect when they visit the plant, for instance, the steel plant. And you see, of course, all the sparks at the beginning of the film in the credit sequence. And at the end, there's also very interesting context in terms of this quasi-historical situation, even though it's just, I think, just shallowly linked to the actual industrial families here. But I think it's just this cast of characters that all, I think, exude the sense of decadence. I'm thinking also of the mother, Ingrid Thulin, or Dirk Bogarde, who's always such an interesting, ambiguous actor to watch. And Thulin is the same, right? We know her mostly from Ingmar Bergman's cinema, but she's so interesting to watch in this one because, as you say, we try to cling on to people that we like for one or the other reason. And you can't. You can't empathize with any of the sons. Some of them are just maybe poor victims. Charlotte Rampling has a bit of a victim role that's where she seems like likable, or at least you sympathize with her and her husband, who's then also persecuted, and the family itself as well. But there's really nothing to cling on to. And the only likable characters get abused. I'm thinking of the girl that Martin goes to see. You know, this Jewish girl, which is also a horrible kind of out of the ordinary scene, you know, almost like the essay killing. I'm thinking of the time when he goes to this house and abuses this girl. I mean, that's also straight out of the horror film. Again, I had these flashbacks to mostly horror cinema. So yeah, a cast of characters, none of whom are likable, relatable, and still there is such a dark fascination in watching them. Also within these sets, can we just talk about that house set, you know, the detail that Visconti must have put into every small, you know, fork and knife and glass and wine, apparently very specific about what they would have at this dinner table or in the rooms. There's such a, I think it has such an impact on the watching experience.
I mean, I think that's something I've always sort of associated with Visconti is that level of, I'd almost say opulence on screen, a level of detail that he puts that is always a bit of a front, that is always something that he's saying that like a world like this never quite works like this. Like this is all a facade to some extent, this level of manners. And I think I've liked that in his other films. I've never seen it taken to this level before. The decadence, the precision, the sort of beauty, but also seediness of the house. It's just incredible. I mean, it looks ravishing, but it also somehow, something about it feels wrong. There is something, there's a darkness beneath it. And I think that's really why Dirk Bogarde is perfect for this film, because you've got the aspect of him as being, I mean, he's past his prime a little bit, but he's still got like, you know, leading man looks. He's still got, you know, the presence of a mainstream leading actor. But of course, he did have a dark side, and he had the secret side of his life. He had stuff going on beneath the sort of Hollywood good looks. And it kind of, he fits perfectly into this world that you see this, you know, this figure who is, he is a lead in a film. He fits just like the house. He has that combination of, there's a level of it looking really striking and in some sense beautiful, but also there's something hidden. There's something under the surface. And he plays that brilliantly. He's perfect for that.
Mm-hmm. And the artifice that is put into the house as well, I think, which mirrors that, or those characters as well. It's interesting about Dirk Bogarde also that he went on to play Aschenbach in Death in Venice shortly afterwards for Visconti. I think they really found a liking for each other and for these ambiguous German characters for Bogarde, and obviously for Helmut Berger as well, who played Ludwig II and a few years after that. So I think what struck me this time also is how closed in these places are. I think with the exception of the Bad Wiese scene, most of the scenes are actually indoors and you never quite see outside of that house, for instance. It's always like the evening or the night. There's no windows through which you would see anything, or they're inside some factory or some closed in claustrophobic house. And then the house, the family house itself, is quite grand. I mean, there's this like staircase and the gallery and the dining room. Everything is like super over the top in terms of like, but you do feel that it's not quite real, right? The colors, the light, it uses this studio set to such double effect, right? In a way you think it's real and this is like so detailed, but at the same time, it's like a stage set or an opera set that cannot be.
Yeah, there's definitely like an uncanniness to it that you can't quite put your finger on exactly how it works, but there is something that it gets to you emotionally that something's not quite right. I mean, in reference to Giallo, I do wonder that the way they do dubbing, that also creates a slightly odd feeling to it. Because I watched it in English, but those studios, my understanding is those studios, that because they were sort of in the city, they couldn't get rid of all the background sound. The studio wasn't set up to be really good for recording the people speaking as they were. So lots of films made there, you know, you filmed it, but then all the dialogue, all the sounds were put on afterwards, like in post-production, dubbing. And so this sort of creates this sort of, you can't quite sense why, but there's an uncanniness that you're watching someone say words and the words are coming out, but there's a fraction slightly odd with it. I mean, that's across, you know, you get that with Leone films, you get that with a lot of like Italian films, but that just works so well alongside the uncanniness of the house, alongside the fact that you're being presented with all this pretense that is hiding something, that this is like, yeah, they're not quite saying what they're saying, or there's something slightly wrong here that I don't quite understand, and it's getting darker. And the experience of watching the film, I think it adds to it in this case, which I think it does with the Giallo films. I think when they're unsettling, they're somehow made more unsettling by the way they're dubbed. And I think that works with this film as well.
Yeah, and I think just the overlap as well, if we think of the production history, I mean, in the same year or shortly before Once Upon a Time in the West had come out, co-written by Dario Argento, then this one has Visconti, obviously, and his team, but some of the actors would go on to be great in Giallo film, especially Florinda Bolcan, who's in, you know, a handful of these Gialli afterwards. And they're all filmed at Cinecittà, probably with similar people who, you know, do the lighting, who build the sets. So I think whether it's a so-called spaghetti Western or Visconti or Argento coming in probably less than a year later to make, you know, Birds with a Crystal Plumage, I'm thinking this is really a through line here. So even though we're watching different genres and we feel it's very different directors and aesthetics, but I think the people on the ground, the carpenters and the painters and the engineers on set, they're probably the same people. And that's why I think we also have, besides the sound and maybe the context, we have such similarities with these films, maybe to some effect at least. But this one, of course, is the one that cuts the deepest because, I mean, you can shrug off a Leone Western or be excited about it and be maybe grossed out by the violence in a Giallo. But this one is, of course, really cutting to like immorality and decay and family, you know, the deepest of all family issues. So it's the one that really stays with you the most.
And I think I do wonder, it was a thought watching this, that whether it's the first time that I've seen where I thought the director probably is aware that everything is going to have to be dubbed afterwards, but he is going to make it work to make his film even more darker and disturbing. So rather than it being like, it's something we have to do because we don't have the facilities here to do it at the time, it adds to the film here. And then maybe, I think some of the Giallo films said that worked really well. That made the darkness darker and more uncanny. And it's interesting that it's, you know, that you were saying about it being dubbed in different languages, that whether it's got the similar vibe that he was able to translate into different versions. But yeah, just how it creates the atmosphere of the film. It's unlike his other films, I think, in terms of how far it goes that I've seen. And that it also is just unlike other films I've seen at all. I mean, I really found it fascinating that it was this dark, but also the way it was dark.
I think it's also a film like no other to me. I had the same impression also watching it again. I can see why this was such a standout. Seeing it so early, obviously for the traumatic elements, but also it gave you the impression that cinema must be a little bit like that from that era, or there must be more films like these. And I think some come close, including some by Visconti and some Italian films from that era, at least aesthetically. But it is one of a kind. And I think it also has a couple of roles. I think the standout to me is Helmut Berger's role, that apparently was also enlarged because, of course, Visconti, you know, had started a relationship with him, and this whole like story of people getting annoyed that this character would become more and more important in the course of the filmmaking. So I think he's really starting with the Marlene Dietrich bit, basically Weimar to Nazi, right? He's the representative of that transition. He starts off as kind of like a drag performer, and at the end he's doing the Nazi salute. So I think that is such a memorable story arc in itself, together with everything that goes on in the family and the historical moments that are here reenacted to a certain extent. I think it is really a film like no other that I've seen.
And I think what was sort of interesting about it does show, I think, yeah, that journey from Weimar to Nazism, but it does it in a way that you realize this wasn't just some sudden aberration. This wasn't something that sort of like the pendulum swung from one to the other and it's a mystery how it happened. I think it really showed you that like all the aspects that lead him, I agree with you, it's an incredible performance, but all the aspects that lead him to the end are there at the beginning. It's the same character. It doesn't feel like, oh, the character changes, he becomes someone else. It is the same person. He is someone who is wealthy, entitled, who has an attitude that he wants, you know, he can do what he wants. Those people thrived in Weimar and they are going to thrive in Nazi Germany. And it's not this sudden change that I think sometimes history will state it as. It's very much Nazism came from this world, and you can't be that surprised it came from this world, because look at it, this darkness is here. And again, I find that really interesting, because it's not the comforting story of, you know, the Weimar Republic was democratic, wasn't perfect, but it was all right, and then these bad guys turned up and ruined it. The bad guys are here. They're underneath it all. And the atmosphere and the way it builds in that, yeah, it's unlike any other film. It's really striking.
Yeah, it's in the DNA already of these characters. And I think the Helmut Becker character is kind of front and center of that. But of course, it's also true for the others, you know, whether they're already getting into gear, into that position, or whether they will realize later. But there's also, yeah, there's no mobility, right? People can either flee and try to escape, but probably will not succeed in the long run, or they're doomed. And I think that's why The Damned is also such a good title, even though the title switches between, you know, in German it's called Götterdämmerung, just like in Italian. So there's a bit of confusion also around the title, but I think The Damned is such a fitting title for that. They are doomed, they are damned, whatever they do.
Yeah, and even the characters, obviously, because we know how history ended up, even the characters that have, you know, won at the end of this film, we know they're damned as well. This isn't going to last. These people are not going to win the war that's coming. So, yeah, it's across the board. Everyone's damned by the end of it if they've not been killed. So that, and you feel it. You feel like even though the characters have won, that there is something about them that is doomed. They feel the darkness will not escape it at the end. And I don't mean that in a sort of twee, oh, justice is coming for them way. I don't mean it as that. It's just the sort of the mood of the piece just makes it feel like this isn't a triumph. There is something else here. There's something darker here, which I think is sort of like an incredible achievement.
And actually you feel, yeah, justice is not coming at this point at all. I think it's just a point where things are getting started. I also thought of, this is only supposed to be the 1933-34 Nazi takeover. And then we know what happened. You know, it's also, there's also this sense of like doom also because you know from history what's coming and how long it took, and probably that some of these characters would survive even later on, even in post-war Germany or elsewhere, or escape somewhere. So yeah, there's maybe also that sense. The more you know about history, the more burdensome this film becomes. So it's not less traumatic. It's actually, you know, I'm just going to see if I cure my trauma. I probably have not. I just admire the film incredibly for what it does, but it is a deeply, deeply disturbing film still.
One thing I think I've sort of mentioned, we've covered other films from the 70s, which is sort of famously quite a sort of a dark decade, or films in the late 60s when happy endings were no longer guaranteed. And I've criticized other films we've done because I think there's an element of they're doing really bleak stuff for the sake of shocking you. It doesn't quite land. There's a level of something horrible happens. And in lots of other films, I find that quite alienating. And what really struck me about this is that never happened. I never felt, oh, you're just showing me something terrible, or have revulsion at this. But it's not, it's being done almost for the sake of it, I feel, in a lot of films in that era. I know we did in the podcast, and I'm trying to remember the name. Is it The Day of the Locust?
Oh, yeah.
I struggled with that a bit, because I think there's moments in that film where it goes, here's a really horrible thing that happened, but it felt really contrived. It was put in there just for a sort of a level of shock value. And although this has moments that are deliberately being repulsive, there is, I think, an intelligence to the filmmaking and how it's put together that I never felt that. I never felt, oh, you're just trying to shock me with something. Everything felt like this has a point to it. It really struck me, and I've seen enough films trying to be shocking for the sake of it, to show awful things, and I've been really detached from them. And I've sort of goes, yeah, yeah, you're just trying to be, oh, you're just trying to be difficult, you're trying to be dangerous. And I've kind of not, you know, I've sort of been able to say, maintain a distance from the film, and I've kind of not been that impressed by it. Whereas this, I couldn't do that. You know, when the awful things are happening, you are drawn into the film rather than necessarily like just show, you know, and sort of become detached from it. I thought that was one of its absolute strengths as a film, that it plays in that world of this is a film that's going to show you shocking things, but it's not a film that just exists solely for that purpose. There's an intelligence behind it. And I think it is doing this for a reason, a sort of level of anger, a sort of level of commentary about how this happened, that I found really engaging.
I know this is genuine, and I think Visconti had a genuine interest, because he basically made three films about German history, right, in a row, a genuine interest in getting to the core of some of the mythology and some of the history that especially German culture had gone through. But I think in all of his films, also Gattopardo or Senso or some of his later films, you can see this is really a director that is so serious about the subject matter, not just down to the details of like sets and characters and so on, but also in what he wants to achieve as a filmmaker. That's why I think in retrospect, such an interesting filmmaker to get to know so early, because of course in my mind afterwards, I was like, well, that's what filmmaking is. It's these like highly complex historical films that have a deep impact. And I remember shortly afterwards, I got to know David Lynch because of my sister. Remember this whole getting into the Lynch world. And that was another great director that I got to know. But then later on, you realize you kind of found directors that are really unique and very, very thorough in their filmmaking and the impact that their films have on audiences. That's not the case for most filmmakers.
Yes.
These are really exceptional people. But you think, well, this is how cinema is. And then, you, of course, one tends to be a little disappointed finding out that the ratio of such good films and directors is not quite as high. But yeah, definitely what a treat. And also, I think, maybe a final thought, it's a film that did age really well, I think.
Yeah.
It did not feel like I was watching a representation of history from the 70s or from the late 60s. It did not feel necessarily that I was constantly thinking about the context in which this was made. It holds up really well in terms of like the impact it has, even if, you know, obviously the aesthetics and some of the filmmaking and some of the music especially clearly reeks of 60s, 70s cinema, but it has not diminished the effect that the film has at all to me.
And in terms of a second chance, are you glad you went back and sort of faced the trauma?
Oh yeah, I'm going to go back again. You know, I have this edition with like documentaries that I watched all in a row. It was like, you wanted to find out more about this film afterwards. There's an excellent essay as well within the booklet that I read, and it's really fascinating too. So it is really a film to go deeper into as time goes by, for sure.
Well, I'm glad there's a second chance it helped, you know, come to terms with like initial childhood trauma, and you've been able to
put some of it.
But I think from the darkness of the damned, let's move on to my choice for second chances, which I think probably couldn't be more different, because my selection was the Coen brothers' Hail Caesar. I think the reason I selected this is I think it was one of the most disappointing cinema outings that I can remember, because I was so hyped for it. I am such a massive fan of the Coen brothers, and I think several of their films I think are absolutely amazing. And this seemed set in a world that is classic Hollywood. It's behind the scenes in the age of the golden age of the studio system, which I love reading about that. And I thought they've made a comedy set in this world. This is possibly going to be my favorite film of this year, if not for a long time. And I think I was quite underwhelmed by it in the cinema. And because the high had been so high, that underwhelming felt massive. It really, like, the shift to watching it and coming out the cinema and, you know, it's not a bad film, but it just felt like a shrug of a film, which, given the excitement going in, really felt like the roller coaster was the higher and lower than most cinematic experiences. So I've sort of avoided it after that because I thought, well, I didn't really like it. And I've gone back and rewatched earlier Coen Brothers and still really like those. So I don't think I'm going off them. And part of me was thinking, right, this is the time. Enough time has passed to give it another chance and to just see whether I just wasn't in the mood that day. And it was interesting. I think going in with low expectations helped. I definitely was glad to rewatch it. I still think it's definitely one of the weaker Coen Brothers films for me. But I think watching it with that in mind, you do start seeing the glasses quarter full rather than three quarters empty. The bits that work, I was like, oh, I'm enjoying this more than I think when you're sort of watching a film going, where is this going and why am I not enjoying it? So how did you find this?
Well, it's so interesting because I came to this film probably from the exact opposite end. Regular listeners of our podcast will know that we've had a dedicated Second Chances with Coen Brothers films, mostly because I said that I didn't like particularly the Coen cinematic world. I liked some of the films, but not had avoided a number of the films that came out because I was kind of skeptical around the Coen Brothers and some of the 90s and noughties eras and some of the films I had seen. I had not seen Hail Caesar at all before this podcast. I kind of thought it looked kind of silly comedy about that era in Hollywood and Coen Brothers, oh no, I'm not going to see it. So this was my first chance to see it. And I must say, I really, really enjoyed it.
Oh, excellent.
This was a very, very enjoyable Coen Brothers entry. I'm even going to go as far as to say it is probably one of my favorites that I've seen so far. Unexpected in its like light tone on the one hand, or on the surface light tone. These very weird, also kind of digitalized aesthetics to recreate the 50s world. There were some jarring moments, but I thought they were maybe like consciously jarring. I'm not quite sure. And I really enjoyed this comic setup of the communists kidnapping George Clooney, the monumental movies that are being made on the studio lot, all the references to classic Hollywood, the cast of 100, you know, that are showing up in this film, having bit pieces. Nothing really makes an awful lot of like dramatic sense, except for maybe the Josh Brolin leading character that you kind of follow through in the film and the George Clooney character to some extent. But the vignettes, the scenes, the musical numbers, the, you know, a Hedda Hopper kind of journalist bit with Tilda Swinton. There were a lot, and Frances McDormand as the editor, that was one of my favorite scenes when she almost gets choked by her own scarf. There was just stuff where I laughed out loud and I caught myself laughing out loud and I thought, I guess I'm really enjoying this film. So what was your reaction to now seeing it again? Was it similar? Did you also enjoy it quite a bit more or just in bits and pieces?
Definitely enjoyed it more. I think partly because those moments, those sort of little vignettes that are funny, you can just enjoy them for being funny. And I think it's a shame George Clooney doesn't play his comedy bad actor more. I think he is brilliant in this. And there's scenes like where he's meant to be playing the Roman in this serious drama and how he captures him as a bad actor.
Yeah.
I think there's a scene where he races to the front of the queue and faces Jesus. And I definitely laughed out loud at that. There's just this sort of like really bad actor overhamming it up, but not too far that it goes over the top. It just is incredibly bad acting. I really enjoyed that. I think, yeah, the editing of that. I think it's still weird to me that there are moments that I just think I should love this and I can't. And I think one of the main things I really picked on in this is the musical numbers. And I think to put that into context, that like if you watch something like The Big Lebowski, that kind of has this sort of psychedelic musical number halfway through, which is incredibly inventive, that really feels like nothing you've seen before, that it's almost like Busby Berkeley doing a slightly weird dream someone obsessed with bowling is having. It's an incredibly weird, beautiful set piece. And in this film, the set pieces just feel like quite good set pieces, filmed now, so they look a bit cheaper than they do when you see them in all their sort of epic glory. It sort of lacked that madness, that edge of madness that I thought I sort of expect from the Coen brothers. And I think why I struggle with this film is I want that little extra. I want that little twist that they know a genre so well that they then start to subvert it. They then start to go, right, we're going to do something different with it. And what I think is brilliant is often they do that visually. So you can see something that feels like a noir, but visually something will happen that you will never expect in a noir or a gangster film. This doesn't really happen in this film. The musical numbers are nice, but that's all they seem to be to me. And I kept wanting them, you've got the underwater sequence with Scarlett Johansson, but then you've got the sailors dance sequence. But they always feel contained within the set they're in. And I feel that's a shame, because when the Coen brothers go a bit wild, just that then they produce sort of amazing moments and sequences. Like there's also in the Hudsucker Proxy, there's a dream sequence that sort of descends into like just a two people dancing, and it's completely unlike anything you'd expect from this film. But it's also strangely beautiful. And this just, they look like nice dancing sequences. And I just feel weirdly disappointed by that.
There's this a strange reverence to classic Hollywood. I mean, not a strange one, I guess, one that you would expect from other directors, maybe more likely than from the Coens. I think, you know, the underwater kind of this Esther Williams scene, or the on the town sailors, and
yeah.
I guess also the Soviet, you know, approaching the Soviet submarine, this kind of like image of, I think it's from an American painting, right? The boat that approaches the shoreline, but then approaching the submarine. I mean, there was nice stuff in there, but it didn't go beyond that. And I was wondering, because it looks so artificial, whether that was part of it or whether 2016 just had like worse digital effects. Because some of the things, for instance, the house in Malibu, where they take George Clooney and he meets all the communists, which is a hilarious scene. And I love the dialogue on that one. But this artificial bay with the view from this like modernist house, it looked fake. And I was wondering if that's like kind of like a winky face fake that they wanted to look just like the underwater scene with Scarlett Johansson. The water looked so fake. And I thought, well, is this part of the concept to make this look like a comic book version of that time that really doesn't look real? Or is that just the level of effects that they had available at the time? And that makes a difference, I think. It's almost like the discussion around Hitchcock and Marnie and, you know, shoddy sets, or is the artifice baked into the concept of the film? And I didn't quite figure it out, but I must say it was still very funny and enjoyable with everything else. So this didn't bother me as much. And the sequences were short and relatively unrelated. And I think the cowboy scenes, or the scenes with the Doyle character by Alden Ehrenreich, the really bad actor,
yeah,
that they want to make into like a dramatic actor. I mean, it's hilarious, this bit. And I think that works much better than all the more effects-driven, laden scenes. So it didn't bother me as much, but I was wondering if that's like part of the idea.
I think my take was probably that it felt like it was just the budget wasn't there, that they didn't, you know, they were working with a limited budget that imposed it. But I think, I mean, one of the things I think when the Coen brothers make a film in a world that obviously isn't real, a slightly fantastical world, a slightly world that has these flourishes of imagination, what I really love about them often is that I remember seeing a comment about the Hudsucker Proxy, that they go into a room and it's this like, it's in this big corporation office. They've got this place with the sorting room. And it sort of said, these are not normal filing cabinets. These are filing cabinets that have died and gone to heaven. They're bigger, they're more striking, they're more fabulous than any filing cabinet. They're clearly filing cabinets, but just sort of blown up massively to this like crazy scale and look. And they do that so well. And it's not in this film. There never feels like the moment where this is now going to be, we're in this weird world of the studio system. And then that level of amping it up to something that feels like crazy that you've not seen before. And I think as well, they do have this way of making films that almost feels slightly meandering, that the story isn't important. You're following these characters, so like The Big Lebowski or Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? It feels a bit sort of invented as they go along. But I do think with the other ones, you get within that sort of meandering journey, you do get a sense of darkness that I do appreciate. That, okay, it's very lightweight, but there is something maybe nasty here or unpredictable here. There is a sense of peril or of mystery. And I think with this rewatch, I think more than anything, it was the absence of any of that that I felt. So the scenes are just there, right? We've got something. And they're really funny ideas. I love the Tilda Swinton being the two gossip columnist identical twins. I do like the scene where they get the sort of all the different religious people to comment on the script. And some of the comments are just like, well, it's not well written. And those really work as sort of standalone, almost sketches. But I suddenly realized I think I like the other films more, that you have all these moments in a meandering screenplay, but something ties it together, something that is slightly darker than a comedy or a mystery to it, or a sense of peril, that there might be a death that's genuinely shocking in the middle of a ridiculous comedy, or the world suddenly doesn't work how you think it should. Again, in the middle of a ridiculous comedy, there's suddenly they throw these huge changes in. And this just doesn't have that. It sort of meanders without any of that. And I find that a little bit boring compared to the other Coen Brothers film. That sort of lack, I think, is ultimately why I think it's a lower order Coen Brothers film. Even because I think the casting's brilliant. I can pick scenes that work so well. I can pick images that work so well. There's like when, just another moment I laughed out loud is when they are bringing the money to the Soviet submarine. And then the bag gets dropped in the water and it just cuts to all the communists on a boat. And it's the funniest collection of sad faces I've seen in a long time. Just like they're all just like, they've all just realized that everything they've done in this film has come to nothing. It's all been completely pointless. And it just was sort of like this, that they all look slightly caricatures anyway, because they all have this distinct look as this like group of Hollywood communists. But just them all looking sad was like a beautifully realized image. So I am glad I watched it again. I think I got more of it this time because the first watch, I started feeling like I'm not really engaged with this. Where is it going? And then when it wasn't going in the way I hoped it would, I kind of wasn't giving the film a decent chance in the cinema. And I think now to go back to something I've seen before, and like I said, to go in with lower expectations, I was able to see a lot more of the genuinely like funny moments, the stuff, the casting across the board is really solid in this. So the sort of cameo performances are strong. I think Ralph Fiennes is as ever, he's brilliant in this. He can play that character in his sleep and he does it so well. So there was stuff that I did enjoy in it. I just think it's less than the sum of its parts, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Total sense. I think for me, it really helped not to have these Coen Brothers expectations at all. Rather the opposite, where I was a bit skeptical, even though I did like these films that I have had seen since. But this one is just a standalone fun film. I think I recently had a discussion with someone else about comedy. What you find funny and what makes you laugh out loud is often an automatic thing, right? You don't control laughter. And I think it's a good sign, the frequency of laughter in a comedy or in a film in general, I guess, maybe also inadvertently so. But here I caught myself laughing often, and I think there are memorable scenes. I would definitely go back and watch it again because I would look forward to actually scenes coming up. So maybe it's a standalone film in that sense that they just made a good comedy about Hollywood, and maybe due to budget constraints it looks a little cheap, and I think to me that actually adds to the comedy and the comical quality of the film. Great cast, as usual, I guess, with the Coen brothers. They are able to assemble great people who have great timing, and I think I also really enjoyed that maybe instead of bringing in the darkness, that they just made this a kind of a love letter to Hollywood of that time, with a few heavy winks, you know, with like the anti-communist craze and all these names, you know, there's Carlotta Valdez, right, who's the girlfriend of one of the characters. I was like, oh, Vertigo, ha ha ha. There's so many things that you can enjoy about this as a film fan as well. But I think the basic thing about this kidnapping is funny. It has funny lines, funny moments. Doesn't really do much beyond that as a whole. But yeah, I never looked at the clock. I thought it was like fluffy and light and a breeze to watch. And it would definitely, you know, if you told me to watch it again today, I would. I would look forward to it even. So I guess the Coens have created something unique as well, but definitely not up there with a lot of their most appreciated works, I guess, as a non-Coen expert.
And I think the other thing I sort of put in my notes is It's surprisingly, what's the best word, I think? It's surprisingly pedestrian in its direction. So when the script is good, I think visually, which probably is to some extent, this is the golden age of Hollywood. So there is a level of static cameras, there's a level of, because one thing I really like about them is they do sort of emerge alongside Sam Raimi. And in their early films, especially when, I mean, some of the early films, they are literally working together. But that sort of Sam Raimi's manic camera looking, the way the camera has so energetic where it'll travel where you wouldn't expect a camera to go. There's like a speed to the best of Sam Raimi that is almost cartoony that he brings to films that the Coen brothers do really well. And I just don't see in this film. And it probably is they decided, well, we can't really do it because this is the golden age of Hollywood and we want something a bit more stately to fit the way films were made then. But I just sort of wanted that sort of crazy camera work, you know, the close-ups that go too close, the camera that moves too fast that you'd normally expect. Sam Raimi does that and they do it really well in so many of their films. And I think, you know, this is probably the one I would put it most close to is like the Hudsucker Proxy, and it's sort of a period drama that's set in a slightly imaginative, slightly comic, lighthearted world. And I think the direction, just the visual direction in the Hudsucker Proxy is so much more energetic than this. And again, they probably did mean to go down this route. It was just something I miss in it. I just sort of wanted a bit more of that energy that directing like that can give to a comedy.
They give it an interesting vintage look, I think, with the use of colors and filters and so on. So you do feel, especially the beginning with that monumental historical Jesus film, that really looks like these monumental Jesus films with the cinema scope. And shout out to Carter Burwell, who wrote a really, really good score for this one. It sounds like Miklos Rocha, right, at the beginning. And then it veers into, with really staying close to like the true Hollywood sound of that time, but it veers a little bit into Coen territory again and again. So I really enjoyed actually the music in this one. I thought, yeah, this is probably what the film is. It tries to be close to these like role models from that time, but then also tell this crazy story of the communist capturing Charlton Heston, basically, yeah. Right? I mean, that's who he is. And then making some hilarious moments out of that, including the slapping scene, which is also, by the way, a favorite. When Josh Brolin just continues slapping George Clooney until he has slapped the communist out of him. I mean, there's just great stuff in this. So yeah. Even without the different, you know, specialities of the Coen brothers that they have in other parts, but there's enough stuff to really admire in this. And yeah, without it going too deep into their usual territory.
Yeah, and I think I'm glad I rewatched that. I think it was the only Coen brothers film that you can buy that I didn't own. So I finally sort of went round and thought, all right, I should buy it now to rewatch it. And
I would own it.
Yeah, and I'm not getting rid of it. It's still going to stay on the shelves. So it's now with the other films. I think, you know, I've made peace with that initial disappointment that came with seeing it on the big screen. I think because, yeah, the moments that, I mean, we're laughing at as we're recalling them here because they are funny. And I can't remember who said once that, you know, in a comedy film, if you laugh out loud 5 times, that's enough. And yeah, I did pass that test.
I did. Definitely.
So I think with both these films, I think we're in a situation where we're glad we went back.
Definitely. And I was going to say, you know, is there anything that connects these two films? I cannot think of anything right now, with the exception that, of course, rewatching them, I think, was really worthwhile, or watching them for the first time, like we did in each case, because they do have strong qualities, maybe not what you expect, but definitely two worthwhile films to revisit for very, very different reasons.
I would definitely suggest don't double bill these films. If you do watch them, watch them on different days. Although I do recommend the order maybe we've done this time, because after you finish watching The Damned, you probably will want something more comic. But very different films. And I was trying to think before we recorded of a connection, a linking material, but I think we're just going to have to say the linking material is we're giving it a second chance.
That's that. I can't think of anything else.
No, that's excellent. So, well, I think on that note of two films we're glad we revisited, I think it's just time to say thank you to all the listeners for joining us for another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. And thank you, Sam, for suggesting a film I hadn't seen that is enjoy the right word. I think I'm glad I saw it. I think it's a film that's worth seeing.
Yeah. I'm also trying to
think
of the right words here.
It definitely failed the five laughs in a film test. I wouldn't recommend that with The Damned.
Zero laughs, actually. Zero laughs.
But it is a film that is definitely worth watching.
Oh yeah.
So thanks for recommending that, and to everyone listening, join us next time for another damn fine cup of culture.